My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. We hope you'll stay tuned. We are joined on the line by Rachel Stoll, who is with the Center for Defense Information. Rachel, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be out in California.
Well, great.
Even if it's just by phone.
That's right. Well, you've had a tremendously busy week of being out of the country and all of that. And I'd like us to talk about the Hague Peace Conference in just a moment. But let me let the listeners know that Rachel Stoll is a research analyst at the Center for Defense Information. Her research areas include the international arms trade, conventional weapons, small arms and light weapons, land masses, UN issues, and child soldiers. Ms. Stoll completed a Herbert Scoville Peace Fellowship at the British American Security Information Council, which is BASIC. While at BASIC, Ms. Stoll wrote the report Deadly Rounds, Ammunition and Armed Conflict, and co-authored Breaking the Cycle of Violence, Light Weapons Destruction in Central America. Ms. Stoll previously worked at the United Nations Center for Disarmament Affairs in New York, where she worked with the Secretariat on the UN Small Arms Panel, the High-Level Consultation on Post-Conflict Peace Building in West Africa, and with the First Committee, which covers disarmament issues, among other things. And so I am very, very pleased to have Rachel Stoll with us to talk about the issues that we're going to be discussing today, including child soldiers. But first, let's talk about the peace conference that took place in The Hague, as I understand it. It was attended by a number of people, and from what I have heard so far, some really good things were said, and hopefully some good things will happen as a result of the peace conference in The Hague. Rachel, can you let the listeners know what went on there?
Sure. Last week in The Hague was the Hague Appeal for Peace Conference, and it was really dedicated to understanding that peace is a human right. And the slogan was, peace is a human right, time to abolish war. And so what we did was look at all the different aspects of society, from the environment to economics to weapons issues, to really say, how can we, the world community, come together to put an end to war?
Can you let the listeners know who some of the other participants and attendees were?
Sure. There were, I've heard estimates between 5 and 10,000 people. It seemed a lot like 10,000 people there, from over 100 countries. It was mostly members of civil society working at peace organizations or think tanks or research organizations or universities. But there were also quite a few, I guess you could call them celebrities. Kofi Annan addressed the conference, Queen Noor of Jordan. There were quite a few other Nobel Peace Prize laureates such as, José Ramos Horta, I'm trying to think who else was there. Many, many, many people came and spoke, Jody Williams. So they really tried to cover a wide variety of issues to appeal to all people all over the world.
Well, certainly it does sound like a lot of folks were there. I know I was reading about some people who were there from the United States, from the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, to talk about poverty and peace and all of that as well. So a wide-ranging group. Rachel, let me ask you a question, because you used the term most of the people were from quote-unquote civil society.
Uh-huh.
And that's a phrase that's being used a lot in a lot of different venues. When we're talking about people being from civil society, what are we really talking about and what are we comparing it to?
Sure. We're talking about people from either non-governmental organizations or people on the grassroots level, community activists, or even just individuals with an interest in a particular issue. And I think that what we've seen is that since the successful completion of the Ottawa Landmines Treaty, ordinary citizens feel like they can make a difference in the political process.
And we're comparing that, of course, to sort of official government representatives.
Sure.
And all of that.
Certainly you need, at some point, you have to work with policymakers and government officials in changing policy and creating law. But it can be done on such a grassroots level. If you have the motivation on a particular issue, and you have a huge public support for that issue, and then you take that to your public representative or your government official, you can really make a difference. You know, there's the story that was told many, many times at The Hague that, you know, if the sky is falling and one bird puts up his little legs to try and hold it up, it's not going to make a huge difference. But if we all lay down and we all put up our legs, you know, maybe we'll be able to keep that piece of sky up in the air.
Certainly, that makes a tremendous amount of sense. You know, one of the things that's really interesting, let me remind the listeners that we're talking with Rachel Stahl, who is with the Center for Defense Information, and we're currently talking about the Hague Peace Conference, which just took place. And to the best of my knowledge, Rachel, you just got back into the country yesterday.
Yeah, I did. And, so it's actually about 9 o'clock at night for me right now, but
sure.
That's okay.
And we're talking about that. You know, one of the things that really happens, or at least perceives to be happening, is this sort of, you know, unstoppable juggernaut, if you will, of, you know, globalization and corporations and sort of self-centered government, so forth and so on, and that, you know, nothing's happening, nobody's trying to do anything about it. But the reality of the situation is that there are a lot of movements that are really trying to say, hey, wait a minute, there are a lot of movements that are happening around the world, correct?
Absolutely, and that was probably the most inspiring thing for me at the conference, was to see people from all over the world who are working so hard on a variety of issues. I mean, everything from people with disabilities in Uganda, their representative was very vocal about the plague of small arms and how it affects the people of Uganda, to an Eritrean landmine survivor. I mean, I had never met anyone from Eritrea, and in one afternoon I met two people who are actively involved in getting their communities to speak out against injustices against their people. And so it really, you know, every issue that you could possibly think of was represented, from poverty, from disarmament, you know, to the global eradication of nuclear war.
We're talking with Rachel Stahl of the Center for Defense Information about the Hague Peace Conference. Rachel, can you talk a little bit about the proliferation of arms around the world? Because, I mean, you know, we've heard a lot in the United States. There's been a lot of talk about, oh, there's so many guns here domestically and what a problem that is. But, I mean, what about that topic in a world context?
Sure. Worldwide, it's estimated there are between 500 million and 1 billion small arms that are in circulation among every country in the world. And so what you're seeing is, it's not necessarily just the presence of these weapons that leads to conflict, but you're seeing that people have an easier opportunity to turn to the weapons as a tool of violence and as a tool of conflict.
So one of the things, of course, that happens is that these weapons have to come from somewhere.
Sure.
Primarily they come from U.S. arms dealers, correct?
Correct. The U.S. is the number one arms exporter in the world. In terms of small arms, the most popular assault rifle is the AK-47, which was originally made in the former Soviet Union and now is made in a host of countries. But the M16 is used in many, many conflicts around the world in many countries. And as the world's biggest exporter, the U.S. seems to fuel many of the conflicts around the world. I do want to point out that it's not even just arms exports today that are fueling the problem, but if you trace it back to U.S. arms exports to Central America in the 1980s to Afghanistan, these weapons are now turning up again years after the conflict has ended in a different part of the world.
Well, there are a couple of things that really brings to mind, and I mean, I was a couple of years ago down in Guatemala, and of course they were, you know, technically at the end of a 30-something year civil war. But at that point in time, you sort of had roving bands of ex-military people in some cases, and criminals certainly, you know, who were out, robbing, you know, busloads of people, in some cases raping young women. And of course, they were armed. Where did they get these arms? Well, of course, they got these arms, you know, through that conduit of military assistance. At one time they were going to the army or whatever, and of course they find their way into the hands of what some people might consider to be, you know, common criminals and terrorists, correct?
That's absolutely right, and that's one of the reasons why we at CDI are very hesitant to support increased arms exports to countries which perhaps are not perpetrating the violence to this time, but that we cannot guarantee that the weapons will actually end up in the hands of the intended users. There's a lot of diversion from the intended targets, and there's a lot of recycling of weapons from conflict to conflict. Maybe the war in Guatemala is over, But those weapons now that used to be in the hands of government officials have now seeped into civil society and are in the hands of violent thugs.
And let's make it plain that in some cases, at least in my opinion, let me say, that the violent thugs are indeed the governments.
You know? Certainly that is also a problem. And, you know, whoever was our ally today may be our enemy tomorrow. So it's very important that the U.S. is careful to whom we export weapons.
One of the things, and I know we're kind of going a little bit far afield here, but I'm just kind of trying to follow the conversation with things that come to my mind. The name Osama bin Laden came up to me as, of course, somebody who was at one time our great ally, and then all of a sudden became, you know, the devil incarnate. But another thing that somebody brought up regarding the sale of arms is that, you know, in particular, the U.S. in this case, you know, we sell all of this technology and all this weaponry, and then turn around and tell the American people, well, we have to buy new and better and more high tech and more destructive stuff because look at all of this stuff we're faced with in the world. But the reason we're faced with so much of that stuff in the world is because we sold it to them in the first place, right?
Exactly. And one of the dangers in modernizing your military is that you have then a surplus of weapons that have become obsolete. And what we would advocate that would happen was rather than then giving those weapons away, that those weapons are destroyed so that they can't be resold or they can't be diverted or stolen.
We're talking with Rachel Stoll of the Center for Defense Information. My name's Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. Rachel, let's, if we will, move to the topic of child soldiers. And when we're talking about child soldiers, can we let the listeners know, perhaps in general at first, what we're talking about and then what some of the particulars are regarding this issue?
Sure. When we say child soldiers, we're talking about anyone under the age of 18 that participate in armed conflict around the world. And this doesn't necessarily mean a frontline combatant, although it certainly does include them, but would also include using children in a variety of services for military support, such as cooks and messengers, spies, and even sex slaves. Children are often kidnapped to become wives or slaves of military commanders. Currently, we're facing more than 300,000 children that are participating in armed conflict around the world.
One of the things that I was trying to get a handle on, and I was really having a difficult time doing that, and perhaps it's an unfair question to ask you, but do you have some sort of rough idea of how many actual armed conflicts are taking place around the world today?
I believe the number is around 34, something like that, that are currently raging at this time. And that is, you know, depending on, you know, if you include ones that are internal conflicts or external conflicts. But there's approximately 30 armed conflicts that have occurred.
And in at least some, if not most, of these conflicts, we find, quote-unquote, child soldiers or children being involved in the fighting of this war, whether they're frontline soldiers or not?
Well, certainly. In 1996 and 1997, there were over 50 countries that were recruiting children into the armed forces, and they actually participated in over 30 conflicts during those 2 years.
One of the things that I was reading about is that there are, in some cases, these children are... They're being, you used the term kidnapped in some cases. In some cases, they're also being blackmailed as a result of threats to their family. If you don't come and fight with a certain group, you know, we'll kill your family and things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of these groups, and it's not necessarily just rebel groups. It's also governments which are using children as soldiers. But they will say to them, we will kill your family if you don't join us. Or, you know, we will give you money if you do come and join us. And perhaps it's the only reason or the only way for a child's family to survive is if the child goes off and fights. Does that mean that the child's going voluntarily? I don't think so. I think it's absolutely morally reprehensible for anyone to convince a child, regardless of if, you know, it seems that it's voluntary, to participate in armed conflict. So there are many reasons that a child may join. Their family might have already been killed. They might be alone. They might be promised things that actually will never be delivered.
And very often, of course, the people that we're talking about are living in war-torn, poverty-ridden desperation already. And, you know, boy, any possible ray of light, no matter how dangerous that ray of light may seem, you know, could be enough to convince in particular a young person that, you know, what do I have to lose, basically?
Absolutely. And once a child is conscripted to that army, what they will do is either drug the child so that they don't realize the seriousness of what they're doing, or they will force the child to go back to their community and kill someone in that community and then convince them that no one wants them to come back, that they've now isolated themselves, and if they return that they'll be killed, and that army will then protect them.
We're talking with Rachel Stoll of the Center for Defense Information. Rachel, let me ask you, let's talk about some of the particulars, if we can. You talked about the fact that not only rebel groups are using child soldiers, but also some governments are. Can we talk about who some of these groups are and what some of these conflicts are, and kind of narrow down who the people are who are using these children in this way?
Sure. There are... it's mostly thought of as a African problem, that it's the Africans that are using child soldiers. But that just isn't the case. Children are participating in armed conflict in countries like Afghanistan, Colombia, India, Papua New Guinea, Uganda, Turkey. I mean, you could really, any country you can think of in any region of the world is actually using children under 18. There are also countries, such Western countries, the United States, Great Britain, the Netherlands, that are recruiting children under the age of 18 into their militaries. So it really doesn't discriminate between countries or continents.
So, in other words, I mean, many people, as you so suggested, would say, oh, well, this is something that happens in Africa. And, of course, you know, the underlying message in that is, well, they're African, so therefore they're backward and barbarous. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that this kind of thing is happening all over the place. And, you know, of course, Africans are more backward or barbarous than anybody else.
Exactly.
Is what I'm hearing.
A lot of the images that you see are young Africans that are engaged in armed conflict. Sri Lanka, both the rebel group, the Tamil Tigers, and the government of Sri Lanka has used child soldiers and has admitted to using child soldiers.
I'm just saying, I have a program director who looks at me every so often if he thinks I'm going to say something particularly crazy or whatever. I think I make him nervous.
This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program.
Rachel, are you ready to take a phone call?
Absolutely.
Great. Caller, you're live on the air.
I understand that the magical age of 18, that's something for a child, it becomes an adult. That's our culture. But isn't it true that in a lot of these areas that you're speaking of, children, what we would call children, are married and take adult roles at a very earlier age, similar to our culture when our country was founded, where children were marrying and taking adult roles at 14, 13.
You bring up a very good point. What I'm hearing you say is that perhaps we're talking about child soldiers and we're applying our cultural viewpoint to other cultures where that viewpoint might not be valid.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Rachel, can you talk to that?
Sure.
Thank you for calling in.
Unfortunately, I think in a lot of these conflicts, we're actually seeing children as young as 7 years old. So although I would agree with you that there are some cultural differences and that children reach the age of maturity much later or much earlier in life, the problem still remains because you have children as young as 7, 8, 9. You have young teenagers, certainly who are not married, who are not part of their cultural responsibility to be adult at that point. I mean, they still are considered children and are used in different ways than the adult soldiers. They're often pushed to go in the front line. They're sent across fields to see if they have landmines in them. So they're not used in the same way as soldiers over the age of 18.
That was something that I really wanted to get to because it came to my mind when you were speaking is how are these children who are out on the front lines, how are they used? And the thought kept coming into my mind, well, are they used as some form of cannon fodder whereby, you know, we're going to send them out to see if there's an ambush or send them out to see if this particular patch of ground is laden with landmines? I'm hearing you say that happens.
That's absolutely. These children are dispensable and they're fearless. So they don't realize often the danger that they're facing. They're even often often given unloaded weapons because perhaps the group can't afford the ammunition. And they're sent really to draw out the enemy fire. The other thing, going back to that original question, is that the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, which is the, you know, governing international law on children, says in every other circumstance, a child is defined as someone under the age of 18. In everything, in terms of international voting, in terms of labor, every other thing that you can think about. And so to have, even though there might be cultural differences where children are married at a younger age, they still are considered children by this treaty as someone that's under the age of 18.
So when, I mean, if we're going to apply that standard to everyone and under numerous circumstances, mm-hmm. it only seems right to apply that standard to when we're talking about people being put in a position to kill or be killed.
Absolutely.
Rachel, there are a couple of things I wanted to ask you as a result of President Ernesto Zedillo's visit to the United States. We're going to be going to a report about that shortly, so we only have a few minutes left. But what should be done, or what can we do about this issue of child soldiers, and how can we help best address this?
Certainly. Well, one thing that we've started here in the United States is the U.S. campaign to stop the use of child soldiers. And currently, we have over 40 groups that are working to end the use of child soldiers around the world and the United States. So I would encourage your listeners to join the campaign and encourage others to do so. We do have a website which I can provide you.
Please do.
Additionally, we need to contact the President, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense and urge them to raise the age of recruitment participation in armed conflict to the age of 18. There is an international movement to raise the age to 18. We have in the UN system an optional protocol to the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child is being negotiated in Geneva to make it voluntary for countries to say we are not going to use children under 18. Currently, the United States is blocking that progress from occurring. Distribute materials to addressing this issue. This radio show, for example, is an excellent forum for people to understand that there are children around the world being used for child soldiers.
Let me get back to something you said. Is that the United States is blocking this resolution?
Absolutely. There is a working group in Geneva that is trying to draft this optional protocol. And the U.S. as a member of the United Nations has every right to participate. However, the U.S. has never ratified the U.N. Convention on the Rights of the Child and is therefore ineligible to ratify a potential optional protocol. But the U.S. doesn't want the rest of the world to make a voluntary agreement that they would stand outside of. So they are blocking the progress of this group.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, why, in your opinion, would you think that the U.S. would be doing this?
Well, the U.S. is very protective of our policy. We, in this country, recruit children that are 17 into the armed forces. In fact, you could argue our recruitment policies start much younger in the middle schools with junior ROTC programs. And we don't want to have the international community dictate what age we can begin to recruit and enlist people into our armed forces.
Rachel, we just have a couple of minutes left. Can you let listeners know how they could go about getting a hold of the Center for Defense Information?
Certainly.
If they wanted to
our
do that?
World Wide Web, www.cdi.org. And if you're interested in information on child soldiers or the Hague Appeal or any of those issues that we've talked about today, you can go to the Arms Transfer Project. If you're interested in the U.S. campaign to stop the use of child soldiers, you can either go to the CDI website or you can check out www.us-childsoldiers.org.
We have been experiencing some phone difficulties while you were giving out the first web address.
Mm-hmm.
Could you do that one more time? And also, is there a phone number that people could call?
Sure. It's the CDI website is www.cdi.org. And the telephone number is 1-800-CDI-3334.
Rachel Stoll of the Center for Defense Information, thank you for joining us on the program today to talk about the Hague Peace Conference, also discussing some information regarding weapons proliferation throughout the world and the issue of child soldiers. And we would very much like to have you on again if possible.
I would love to be on. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That's it for this edition of the program. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. If you're interested in copies of this or other Full Logic Reverse programs, you can contact us via email at flr@jps.net or by telephone at area code 530-265-9462. Full Logic Reverse is produced at FLR Studios in Nevada City, California, USA. Our music is by Rick Payne. We hope you'll join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.